Today we speak with scholar Aziz Rana about his brilliant and bracing article recently published in the New Left Review, Constitutional Collapse. We talk about how the Trump administration and its enablers are shredding a liberal compact, which was established in the 1930s through the 60s, and extending an imperial presidency abroad to an authoritarian one domestically. We talk about the current constitutional crisis, but also about the need for, and manifestations of, a politics which is at once a genuine membership organization and social community. As Aziz Rana powerfully argues, quote, its aim should be to transform the world people organically experience. This is exactly the analysis and message so many of us need in these dark times. Speaking Out of Place is produced in collaboration with The Creative Process and is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. We hope you enjoy this and other episodes. Please help support Speaking Out of Place by subscribing via our website, speakingoutofplace.com, following us on Instagram, and following me on Blue Sky. You can give me your feedback and suggest people to invite and topics to. So welcome back to the show, Aziz. I'm so grateful to you for being here to walk us through your excellent and very important piece in New Left Review entitled Constitutional Collapse. The moment people started talking about a possible constitutional crisis unfolding in the U.S., I knew I wanted to hear your take on the issue. And this essay contains so much rich background, political analysis, and political prescription that we'll have a lot to talk about. But first of all, I want to do a bit of self-advertising and advise listeners to check out our July 31st, 2024 episode of Speaking Out of Place, where you talk to us about your magisterial book, The Constitutional Bind, How Americans Came to Idolize a Document That Fails Them. And in that conversation, you demystified the Constitution for us and explained how it's a document that is both durable and malleable, but also conservative at its core, but yet also open to radical challenges and appropriation. So it's a true site of contestation. And your essay, Constitutional Collapse, revisits some of these arguments and updates them. So first, Aziz, could you explain this notion of a constitutional compact? Because it is at the center of so much of what we'll talk about in the rest of the show. What is it, and what is there to like and what not to like?
Great. So first, thanks so much for the very kind introduction, and it's wonderful to be back on the show. I really appreciate it. So the thing that I would say is that in the U.S., we have this idea that as just a kind of popular cultural sense, that the countries basically had the same constitution, that there was a document that was ratified in the 1780s, and it's really been in effect since then. But one of the things that's distinctive about the U.S. Constitution is that it's perhaps the hardest in the world to formally amend. So it's incredibly difficult to change the actual terms of the text. And even the times in which we've had pretty profound changes to the language, and here we can think about the Reconstruction period with the passage of the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th Amendment, it required massive social upheaval and interesting deviations even from the existing process. That means is that Constitution and its meaning has actually changed quite dramatically over time, but oftentimes through mechanisms that we can think of as fairly informal. So in the 20th century, the basic way that constitutional change has taken place has been through landmark pieces of legislation, so ordinary pieces of law that gets passed, and then courts interpreting that legislation to be consistent with constitutional meaning in ways that dramatically alter the terms of collective life. And in particular, between the 1930s, so the New Deal period, World War II, and the early Cold War, so especially over the course of three decades from the 30s to the 60s, American constitutional meaning shifted dramatically. And this took place through key bits of legislation, so things like Social Security Act, establishing in the context of the New Deal certain kinds of provisions for folks, but then also the National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act that established collective bargaining, and then we can think of Medicare, but then also the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. what all of these bits of law did, and then that they were ultimately upheld in the courts, is that they established the basic terms of what you can think of as the 20th century constitutional compact. And just very quickly, we can think of this compact as having kind of five elements. So the first is a strong commitment to racial liberalism, which really becomes a key ethical core of the 20th century project. And so this is the idea expressed in the Equal Protection Clause of equal rights for all that undermines the persistence of segregation. So with Brown versus Board of Education, the courts. But then that alongside, especially in the wake of McCarthyism, strong commitments to civil liberties, especially arguments about speech protections, various types of religious protections, based on a juxtaposition between the U.S. and the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany, this idea that there are certain kinds of autonomous space that should be left for individuals free from various types of threat. And so by the end of the 1960s, the U.S. has incredibly permissive dissent and speech regime established through a case called Brandenburg. And then alongside those two elements, there's also a vision of market capitalism, but hemmed in by this new administrative state shaped by the New Deal order. And the administrative state is built on the idea of independent agencies that are established by Congress, but are not just subject to the whim of presidents, so as to maintain some degree of distance from presidents that might be able to just intercede to impose particular kinds of political ends. And then that's alongside an account of checks and balances that really emphasizes a very strong Supreme Court as an arbiter of constitutional meaning, especially given the fact that the text is so hard to formally amend. And all of that is tied to a defense of American global power that's built around an imperial president, so that the president enjoys extreme forms of discretion overseas, but that's supposed to be cabined domestically. And it's this sort of combined framework that really is what the American constitutional model consists in, even if in many ways, it's quite different than what the initial text would have stipulated from the 1780s and 1790s. And it's what many Americans that grew up in this country, the end of the 20th century, the beginning of this one, would have just intuited as the meaning of the American constitutional project. And so that's the compact that has its own really profound weaknesses, I should say, and that has been chipped away bit by bit over the course of the last set of decades, that Trump and the coterie of real extremists that are around him are pushing to the breaking point, that are systematically attacking each one of these constituent elements.
So you mentioned a second ago, it has these weaknesses. What are the weaknesses?
So there's a variety of different ways that we can explore this. The first is just to note something that we discussed last time, and that's increasingly a common part of the conversation about the Constitution, which is the U.S. Constitution, because of its 18th century legacy, is not built electorally on the principle of one person, one vote, but instead built on the central representational unit of the state, so geography. And what that does is that it means that across all of the decision-making apparatuses of the federal government, there's a profound anti-democratic element, so that this impacts the Senate. It shapes the presidency through the Electoral College, through both the Senate and the presidency. It shapes who serves on the Supreme Court. And then it impacts the House of Representatives because of the focus on the state level as the basis for making determinations about representation, even in the House. So you have problems of gerrymandering. And then all of that is connected to the fact that the Constitution's incredibly difficult, again, to formally amend because you need 2/3 in the House, 3/4 of the states. And so the states effectively have a kind of veto on whatever can make its way through the Constitution as a matter of formal change. And so it pushes everything back into the courts. And what this kind of structural framework does is it means that especially during periods of real political polarization, it's incredibly difficult for particular democratic, little d democratic coalitions to have their interests met. So the big D Democratic Party, it's a demographically diverse coalition that's largely urban. But the structure of it means that even when that coalition has pretty substantial majority support, It's incredibly hard to hold all the levers of government. And then even if, let's say, you win, the Senate is already so counter-majoritarian that it's basically you have a supermajority just to have a bare majority in the Senate. And then to get through a filibuster, you need a supermajority on top of that. And this has meant that getting policies passed that the majority of the society might want, incredibly hard, creates a context of paralysis and sense of like fecklessness within the institutions. And at the same time, it means that particular minorities, especially racial and economic minorities that are empowered, so not like historically disadvantaged minorities, but like racial and economic elites, because of this same apparatus, have dramatically elevated power to have their interests met or to stymie or block policy. So by the same token, Republicans can control all the levers of government in these moments of disaffection when they get like a bare majority, because it's much easier to hold the branches and to assert power, for instance, through the Senate, and also to be dramatically overrepresented in the presidency. So you have the example of Republicans winning the presidency despite losing the popular vote, also dramatically overrepresented in the Supreme Court, because you have such a small court. The justices serve for life. There are no meaningful term limits. Most places in the world, you have term limits somewhere between 9 and 15 years. You have a much larger Supreme Court. In Germany, it's 16. In India, it's 34. And the composition is constructed by the Republican Party's president. So Trump loses the popular vote in 2016 and yet is able to get nominated and confirmed three justices when Democrats have only been able to get nominated and confirmed five since 1968. All of this is a structural context that essentially facilitates some of the worst tendencies within the overarching system. And then we can like work through what those tendencies are, which is there's a defense of racial liberalism as really key to national identity, this idea of inclusion for all. But that mid-century compact really was not focused on thinking of race as a structural flaw within the terms of American life. Instead, it was premised on viewing the United States as incompletely liberal, requiring only minor forms of amelioration. And in the context of this system, even at moments where there might be a desire for more full-throated forms of social change since the 1960s, it's been very difficult to get those addressed. The civil liberties story. Yes, you have a commitment to civil liberties, but you also have background social conditions in the country where the last 50 years has seen the rise of an intense form of mass incarceration that really limits and constrains protections for individuals. And you also have had throughout really the Cold War and the post-Cold War period, intense forms of violence perpetrated against disfavored populations as Muslim and Arab constituencies in the context of the war on terror. We can think about black radicals at various points in time. So that the story of McCarthyism isn't just a story of this negative example that was repudiated, but something that was built in to the intensity of American security policy. And that, of course, is tied to the power of the president, so that the president operates through a great deal of discretion overseas, but that also bleeds into the society through actions at the border, so that presidential power is really intense at these places of discretionary violence, through arguments about national security. So all of these are percolating instabilities, and that even applies to thinking about the New Deal order, so that really, the last 50 years has also seen the rise of neoliberal approach to the economy that both parties in various ways have embraced, pushed towards various kinds of deregulation. And on the right, what that's meant is an emerging account of presidential authority, interestingly, even domestically, where you have arguments from conservatives about something called the unitary executive that says these independent agencies that were the product of the New Deal era, they're viewed as a threat to the ability of the president to control policy within the executive branch. And that's generated court jurisprudence as the court has pushed to the right that emphasizes the importance of the court as a kind of imperial court interceding through its processes in what types of administrative arrangements can impose economic regulation, while at the same time steadily unleashing the president to be able to assert power over the administrative apparatus that regulates the economy. The thing that both of those things do together is that they limit or constrain the capacity of various kinds of institutions to be able to contain the worst excesses in capitalism. And now if you take all of this together, it sets the stage in a kind of perfect yeah. or terrible storm for the right, where Trump gets the presidency despite losing the popular vote in 2016. When he's voted out of office, he attempts essentially to overthrow the government by contesting a legitimate election. And yet the constitutional system not only puts him in power, makes it very difficult to hold him accountable, hard to impeach him, hard to criminally prosecute him. He's packed the court effectively so that the justices on the court also provide extensive forms of immunity, limit even the terms by which he could be prosecuted. And then on top of that, there are very few mechanisms within the constitutional system to bar people from running for office if they've attempted to overthrow the government, something that's that is a tool yeah. in other post-dictatorship contexts. Mm-hmm. And so you get to a situation where he's back in power. He's back in power, focused really on vengeance, targeting enemies, enriching allies. He surrounded himself with a coterie of loyalists who are really the most ideologically extreme, so not part in various ways of traditional mm-hmm. Republican officialdom. Yeah. And they're using all of these complexities and instabilities within the compact to essentially go after the foundations of democratic practice and to break that 20th century framework. So you have now a much more full-throated assertion of executive power, whether foreign or domestic. You have a direct assault on civil liberties. You have a direct attack on any brand, really, of racial liberalism and on, which is at its root, it's a project of Trump and especially the folks around Trump to more or less reverse the American 20th century project.
You do such a beautiful job of explaining the imperial presidency overseas to the authoritarian presidency domestically. There's this notion of a constitutional crisis on the horizon based on the deportation cases. And a lot of people are hanging their hopes on that because there was the 7-2 vote, I think, and there was a unanimous vote. Is this a straw that we should be grasping at? Or what's your diagnosis of the notion of a constitutional crisis? Is this going to happen?
My own view is that the country is clearly in a constitutional crisis of some sort, and that it's important to look at Trump's relationship to the courts as a way of highlighting just the extremity of the type of impunity that Trump and those around him are asserting. One of the reasons why it's important for political officials to follow court decisions is the argument that, wait a second, for any kind of democratic politics, liberal, socialist, you have to have a context in which those in power don't see themselves as utterly free from any meaningful constraint, that don't understand the terrain of politics as just a site for imposing fear and intimidation on enemies and enriching in a corrupt fashion their friends. And no actor can really be above the law. So that's a reason why you should care about whether or not Trump is violating court orders. But I think the focus on a crisis as just about whether or not you're abiding by the court really undersells the nature of the moment, which is really much more expansively about constitutional collapse. And it also misunderstands the relationship between democratic forces, so mass mobilization, progressive mass mobilization, and the historical role of the courts. And I think it's important to tease out both. On the first, the way that I read the relationship between Trump and the courts right now is that it's key to note that the federal judiciary is ideologically diverse. So at the district court level, you have a majority of what amount to Democratic Party appointees. The further you get up the appellate framework, the more Republican the appointees are. And by the time you get to the Supreme Court, is not just Republican, but it's incredibly conservative, even by comparison with global dimensions. And so if you just think about what's sort of likely to happen over the long run, it's likely that what you'll see in the courts will be pushback, but also some agreement with elements of the Trump project. Now, the thing that's noteworthy, though, that maybe makes this moment distinctive, is that it's pretty clear that the Supreme Court and the folks on the Supreme Court have been trying to operate in relationship to Trump the way the court operated in relationship to Bush during the War on Terror. So the Bush administration began with practices that were incredibly discretionary, very little space for process, basically designating individuals as enemy combatants, holding them incommunicado, sending the non-citizens to Gitmo, rejecting the need for any kind of tribunal or procedural framework to assess whether or not a person actually is an enemy combatant. What the courts did over time is the courts basically pushed back at this extreme assertion of discretion, saying, look, you're going to need to provide some degree of process. The way that the Bush administration responded was by listening effectively to the courts, developing tribunals like the Combatant Status Review Tribunals that ended up being applied in the context of Gitmo, so frameworks to assess based on some provided evidence whether or not individuals were in fact enemy combatants. Over time, what this basically meant is that it provided the fig leaf of legal process while the Bush administration was able to engage in really extreme forms of rights infringement. Mm. But there was a kind of collaborative relationship between a conservative court and Republican lawyers. The way that I see this moment as perhaps distinct is that there are going to be some areas where Trump's extreme assertions of executive authority, for instance, the context of the unitary executive, perhaps when it comes to some of the stuff around hiring and firing agency officials, where I can imagine the courts largely approving of what Trump's doing. But there are other areas where effectively what the Supreme Court has tried to do is to play the same game. And the difference, I think, right now is that the Trump folks have fired or removed a whole swath of Republican legal officialdom. And it's essentially like the Stephen Millers of the world that are setting this iterative policy. Even Roberts's responses in the context of rights for non-citizens, these were not full-throated victories for civil liberties. These were basically, we can think of the argument that the Trump administration has to facilitate Abrego Garcia's return, but doesn't necessarily have to effectuate the return. Mm. It's basically telling the Trump administration, play ball, show that you're willing in some way to abide by legal process, and you can probably do most of what you want to do. To date, the Trump folks have basically said no. And what that's done is I think it's created this really intense conflict between the presidency and the courts. And we're going to end up seeing how this plays out. But at the same time, I would be wary of if ultimately the courts are pushed because of the refusal of the Trump folks to play ball, if the courts end up taking a much more demonstrative stance against the Trump administration to say that proves that the institutions worked, that the courts are fantastic, because one, the courts are the condition by which we're in the situation in the first place. Like, it's one of the reasons why we've had the facilitation of Trump's authority and even Trump's return to power is because of Supreme Court jurisprudence going all the way back to Citizens United and the unleashing of money in the context of American elections, let alone actions with respect to Trump and impunity. And then there's a second thing, which is this is nonetheless still an incredibly right-wing court that is absolutely a constraint on the capacity of the system to engage in meaningful renewal. And so it very well might be the case in the future, whatever we see now, that you're going to have organized political power from building something like a transformative majority to think about constitutional renewal that might confront actions from the court. And if right now your response is, yay, judicial review, this court is fantastic, thank God for Republican judges that are willing to push back against Trump, it'll be very difficult to then explain why is it that there are circumstances where civil disobedience against a court order, like the letter from the Birmingham jail in its own way. Yeah. Like, why is it that civil disobedience is not only justified, but it's necessary? So you have to be able to, on the one hand, say the thing that's wrong with Trump and the people around Trump is just the absolute disregard for any account of legal limitation in the rule of law, which is an authoritarian mindset that's deeply dangerous. But at the same time, absolutely, there are circumstances in which precisely because of the social conditions generated by the extremity of the court as well, it's necessary to confront court actions, to perhaps engage in various kinds of norm breaking, but norm breaking on behalf of democracy and on behalf effectively of deeper constitutional principles.
When you were speaking about this, me being of my generation, I was thinking of precisely the Watergate moment when the Watergate case broke and Nixon left and the whole notion was trumpeted across the news, the system works. And of course it hadn't. It was a complete fluke. The burglars broke in and they were clumsy and they left a trail of evidence a mile wide. But what that did, and it gets to your second point, is it galvanized the public, regardless of whether it was semi-mythical or not. It gave people the energy to think that there was not only a possibility, but an imperative to use that moment to press for further things. And that's something I really want to drill down on. Near the ending of your essay, you had this great quote, which I'll read back to you and ask you to expand on, because it gets precisely to the things that I think we're most in need of hearing. You write, "Democratic officialdom has been so conditioned by the strictures of the old constitutional compact that they appear signally incapable of deviating from it. This creates a potential opening for the American left. The left must pursue the kind of institution building that can lay the basis for transformative changes to the Constitution and to society at large. This entails protecting and expanding meaning-making institutions which incorporate values of democracy and solidarity into everyday life. We can take party politics as an example. In the U.S., the party is not a genuine membership organization, let alone a social community. And I'm thinking of a lot of what we're seeing, especially from people my generation, but it percolates down, is something that you referred to earlier in our conversation, which was the New Deal. This really put into place a sense of what life should be. You should have these protections. You should have these benefits. You should be able to look forward to your retirement, for example. And this has been passed down generation to generation, except at this moment. So I think we have this great rupture between what we expect out of life and what we're seeing Trump delivering to us, plus what Trump is shredding. And as you say in your article, the Democratic Party is still playing this outmoded game of party politics that's so detached from a vibrant political possibility in a population that's sensitized to what a good life should be and could be and used to be for their grandparents, but is not now for theirs. And then you throw into this, of course, the environmental collapse as well. Could you talk more about the potential that you see for a social movement that's separated from an outmoded party apparatus that might have more hope for us and certainly more to give us in terms of our sense of capacity and morale?
Absolutely. So I think, and this is, in a way, this connects both the mainstream of the Democratic Party and the folks in the commentariat that are engaged in extreme veneration of the courts at this moment, which yeah. is there is a sustained avoidance of why are we seeing this collapse and an effort by Trump to essentially break all of the elements of the 20th century project at this moment in time. And that requires an analysis of how we got to this place. And I think one of the things that it requires appreciating is that those decades between the 30s and the 60s were really historically unusual. They're exceptional in various ways because of the combination in the 30s and 40s of such organized working class power through unions that produced these huge supermajorities for FDR to overcome the constitutional order. And then the particular dynamics of World War II and especially the Cold War against the backdrop of decolonization that pushed the center left and the center right toward a kind of detente and agreement about these various elements. And that not only led to real crackdowns on the left that we've discussed previously, but it also pushed the center-right to essentially break from some of the more extreme elements of its own far. And one of the things that's really happened since the end of the Cold War and the sort of the dominance of the U.S. as a unipolar power and that we've seen over the last decades is a kind of fundamentalism of the mid-century project, a fundamentalism around the market, a fundamentalism around the genius of the institutions, around American exceptionalism, American power. And it's also produced, not unrelatedly, sustained and increasingly extreme defection of the right from the terms of that compact. And so you have this double feature at present, where you have an emboldened, strengthened by the constitutional institutions that is essentially defected from the 20th century project, and in many ways are frankly like deeply un-American in the sense that they see the changes wrought by the American 20th century as an attack. They want to go back to the world of McKinley, which is a world that Americans really don't have any connection to, that it's as culturally distant as some completely like foreign continent. And at the same time, you have a political center, the Democratic Party, that imagines that you can somehow just go back in time with a leader that's more charismatic, with the courts holding the line, that you can reconstitute the politics from a half century ago, when that's gone too, because it had its own internal failures and it was not up to the challenges of the last decades, including these extensive social crises, the ecological crisis that you described, the national security crises brought by the Iraq war and forever war in Afghanistan, the financial crisis, you name it. And so it means we're at this really interesting moment that's marked by truly grim circumstances. I don't want to undersell this, but in which the right can break the system, but there is no majority. There's really no even like large plurality for a reconstructive far-right project that eliminates the story of the 20th century in the U.S. And so to the extent that the country maintains competitive elections, and we can't take that for granted, but to the extent that occurs, there isn't a reconstructive project on the right besides destruction. And then the center's project of restoration also raises this question about like restoration of what?
Exactly.
And it means that really the only pathway that the U.S. has is a pathway of constitutional, cultural, and political renewal through the ideas of the left. And that's obviously a massive task, but it's also its own opportunity. And it's one of the reasons why the place that I end the piece is to say, look, there are these policy changes that one might want about the nature of our electoral system, about how to shift the constitutional order. But alongside a whole range of policy changes to state and economy, this is a moment for investing in those intermediate meaning-making institutions that people are located in that can do two things at once. They can be sites for courageous resistance against the most extreme forms of violence. And by courageous resistance, actually taking a stand to protect the communities that are under threat and that the center has been incredibly hesitant to defend. So these are non-citizens, trans persons, activists on behalf of Palestine. So this is a moment to use whatever tools that are available. In particular, we're seeing the use of litigation as a tool, something that socialists and radicals did in past moments, even as they called for pretty fundamental changes to the constitutional system. And it's also a time to link that kind of courageous resistance with a kind of renewal of all of the sites that effectively connect people to their cultural worlds. This is what I mean by the workplaces, the neighborhoods, the schools. And one of the things that I think is really noteworthy is the extent to which these have been precisely the places that have been powerful in contesting the rise of the right. So we can think about the AAUP and professional associations within the university context. We can think about legal bar associations that can raise questions about the ethical violations of lawyers that carry out practices that are clearly contradict your basic ethical training, making frivolous arguments to the court or defying court orders or lying to courts, et cetera, et cetera. We can think about medical associations. And then, of course, labor unions, union organizations, and then various other kinds of civic spaces from churches involved in refugee work, that these are all places to work on rebuilding a kind of left cultural world that also at the same time can serve as resistance. And so it provides a context in which left ideas of renewal are just part of the cultural drinking water of the society. Mm-hmm. You did not get to the New Deal until you'd had effectively 50 years of institution building on the left that made left ideas natural to white working class constituents. And the story of the last half century has been the sustained dismantling of those institutions. And this is a moment where you have all of these potential footholds. And it's also one of the things that you can think of consciously, even with relationship to the Democratic Party. I think a missed opportunity of the anti-oligarchy tour that Sanders and AOC have been on, which I think is supportive of, is that in a way, it replicates the kind of charismatic leaderism of the politics around Obama, where one thing that's different about now than 2008, 2009 is you have all of these state and local elected officials that were DSA supported, Working Families Party supported, that are part of a left infrastructure. They might not be that many in Congress, but they're across the nation. And one of the ways to actually build the same type of intermediate institution and to think of even part of the Democratic Party as a membership party is to figure out ways to connect all of these officials across state lines and then to national leaders so that when somebody like AOC comes and gives a talk at a particular location, you're not just like mentioning a politician. Go vote for this person, but you've been in conversation and you understand those folks as an elected base of your party, that you're listening to them when it comes to the kinds of policies that you're pursuing at the national level, or that you're in sustained conversation. And so it feels like there are all of these different networks that go all the way down to the folks that are unelected, but are the kind of the base of that formation. And this feels like a way, on the one hand, to think of the project of the present as a long-term project, but as a project that has both a long durée and an immediate intervention as its core.
No, that's wonderful and exactly the kind of thing that we need to hear. The only thing I would add to it is, and this might be because I'm a humanist and into the notion that there's something about moral revulsion, because I don't know if you remember, it was many years ago when Paul Wolfowitz was Undersecretary of Defense, and somebody, I think at the business school at Stanford, came up with the idea of the markets are all about aggregating information and decision-making, right? So why don't we float the idea of people being able to invest in terrorist futures? In other words, when would a terrorist attack be most likely to happen? And this got out. And within 6 hours of it getting out, they shut it down. Paul Wolfowitz was working with DARPA, and they said, DARPA is very imaginative. Maybe it got too imaginative. But the message I'm taking from that is there was an instinctual distaste and revulsion about making money off of betting on terrorism. The same thing when families were separated at the border. That was a moral revulsion. And I think this is coming back, not only in terms of the border, but in terms of the immense cruelty with which these people operate. In other words, the idea of being unfettered and free and breaking things and seeing what happens. People are feeling more and more as they see their medical insurance being denied or their social security being tapped into, that this is a bad thing to do to human beings. So I think there's both a positive and a negative force that we're approaching from different angles that in a combined manner might be able to drive exactly the kinds of things that both you and I want.
I think this is a really important point because I see the social media efforts of the White House as more than just agitprop or Hegseth's scrubbing of websites of Black, Brown, women, LGBTQ presence, as more than just symbolic. This is an effort to impose an extreme right-wing cultural world on the country. So it's predicated on ethno-nationalism, a version of Christian nationalism. It's built on this rejection. You hear this from tech billionaires of empathy. And it's an effort to mainstream a kind of racialized and exclusionary cruelty as just part of what it means to live in the country. And so a central mechanism for opposing this is also rejecting these kinds of cultural predicates. And it's another reason why I think these institutional places that are tied to how we operate in our communities, in our schools, in our workplaces, in our neighborhoods, that it's really important to assert power at these places and reject these cultural framings. Because in rejecting the cultural framings, you're also defending a specific vision of society built on solidarity, ethical community. And it's one reason why it's an interesting thing. Like, on the one hand, this can feel like a time in which it's really unclear what we can do. Like, that Trump and the people around Trump have all these levers. We're just responding. What is it that one individual can do? But on the other hand, precisely because of how much of the Trumpist project, and it's really a project of all of these different extremists that are around him, is a cultural project to shift the terms of engagement within our own social worlds, that there's actually all these levers that we have precisely where we live and operate, which is we can contest exactly the forms of cruelty that these folks are attempting to mainstream by opposing them at all of the different sites in which we either work or live or interact with others. And this strikes me as absolutely key, that the ethical cannot be separated from what we think of as the big picture policy questions.
Aziz, I always love talking with you because I always leave feeling inspired and informed. So thank you so much for being on the show again. And we'll have you back certainly whenever you want.
It was really my pleasure to be on the show. I'm really glad that we've been able to connect.
Thank you for everything. Bye.
Thank you.